I'm Dr. Hugh Ross, and you're listening to Apologetics Profile and Good Heavens.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA.
My gosh.
They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west.
Look at that thing, dude.
That's not our LNS, though, is it?
It's not. That is an LNS, dude.
Well, if there's like...
Look at that thing.
It's rotating.
You said put on your tinfoil hats. People should put on their battle helmets. Right now, this is being taken seriously from the world public. It's a serious topic, and people need to understand why it's a serious topic. At this time, right now, you've been told something historic. Right now, what you've been told is that UFOs are indeed real, that there is a technological aspect to it, and the world needs to catch up with consensus reality. It is being taken very seriously at the highest levels of government.
You've stated that the government is in possession of potentially non-human spacecraft. Based on your experience and extensive conversations with experts, do you believe our government has made contact with intelligence?
Something I can't discuss in public setting.
If you believe we have crashed craft, stated earlier, do we have the bodies of the pilots who piloted this craft?
As I've stated publicly already in my News Nation interview, biologics came with some of these recoveries, yeah.
Were they, I guess, human or non-human biologics?
Non-human, and that was the assessment of people with direct knowledge on the program I talked to that are currently still on the program.
Now, the strongest evidence I see for deception is where you have automatic writing taking place, where the human contactee is put into a trance and the UFO being basically works through the human contactee to write. The most famous example of that is the Urantia book. The Urantia book is the Bible of four different UFO religions. Now, there's more than four, but there's four that are functioning here in the United States. And these religions, their Bible is the Urantia book. You know, some editions run 4,000 pages. But what's interesting about the Urantia book, a third of its content is focused on denying the deity of Jesus Christ.
Should put on their battle helmets right now.
Put on the helmet of salvation. Gird yourself with the full armor of God, friends. Buckle up. This is going to be a fascinating and enlightening conversation this week and next. Welcome to a special combined episode of Apologetics Profile and Good Heavens. I am Watchman Staff Apologist Daniel Ray and your host this week and next. As you may know, we here at Watchman produce two podcasts, a bi-monthly podcast which focuses on the Christian faith, astronomy, cosmology, and science. We call it Good Heavens, and we produce our weekly apologetics-oriented podcast called Apologetics Profile. This month, we have decided to combine both podcasts to focus on an important topic that has been in the news recently, UAPs, or Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, what used to be termed UFOs, Unidentified Flying Objects. In the introduction, you heard several audio clips that have been responsible for a resurgence of public interest in the topic of UAPs. The first clip featured two Navy fighter jet pilots taken aback by a bizarre object off the Florida coast, an object that is maneuvering in ways that appear to defy the laws of physics. Declassified and released by the Pentagon in 2019, this video has become the banner video for UAP UFO enthusiasts. The second audio clip features popular UFOologist Jeremy Corbell attempting to correct a British journalist who was apparently mocking the idea that people would take UFOs and UAPs seriously. Korbel is convinced there is some form of higher intelligent life visiting or sojourning here on planet Earth, though what exactly that might be, he is careful not to commit to any one particular explanation. Korbel has become the popular go-to spokesperson for UAPs. The third clip features David Grush, a former military intelligence officer, testifying before Congress that he believed the U.S. government has in its possession crashed alien craft, which included non-biological remains. Grush admits he did not actually see the craft or the non-human biologics, as he calls them, only that he was told they exist. The final clip is our very special guest this week and next, Christian astrophysicist, author, and founder of Reasons to Believe, Dr. Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross shares with us the phenomenon of automatic writing, one of the primary means by which alleged alien communication takes place. So, what is really going on with all this renewed interest in UAPs and UFOs? Has new evidence actually come to light? Does some higher form of intelligence exist and is now among us? Is our government housing crashed alien craft and non-human alien remains? What about alien abduction stories? And how should we as Christians respond to a friend, family member, or coworker who is convinced aliens are real? Dr. Ross will give us a very biblical and down-to-earth analysis of all this UAP and alien phenomena this week and next, as we discuss his co-authored 2002 book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. And you don't need to be a scientific expert to comprehend it or share it with others. As far as a Christian perspective on aliens and UFOs go, this book, along with Gary Bates' 2010 book, Alien Intrusion, are two of the best books on the topic. See a link in the notes to our full Good Heavens interview with Gary Bates. As we begin part one, I mentioned to Dr. Ross that though his book was over 20 years old, I discovered upon reading it that it provided nearly identical information about the kinds of beliefs and theories being discussed in the news and social media today. Lights in the Sky, Little Green Men, this came out in 2002, so this is over 20 years, and I decided to dive back into all of the recent cultural interest in UFOs in preparation for our talk. And I ran across a gentleman by the name of Jeremy Korbel. I don't know if you know who Jeremy is. He's a popular UFO enthusiast, a UFOologist. Is that how you pronounce that term, UFOologist? Is that how you say that?
That's correct, although the official term now is UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena.
Gotcha. Okay, so I ran into Jeremy Korbel. And I listened to almost his whole discussion. It was 3 hours. I listened to almost all of it with Joe Rogan last August. And it was fascinating, Dr. Ross, because even though your book is 20 years old or over 20 years old, everything that Jeremy was talking about is exactly what you and Kenneth and Mark outline in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. So this, nothing really has changed in 20 years, except maybe the Pentagon has released some really strange videos. And there was another gentleman by the name of David Grush who has come forth. He seems to be a little bit more than your average UFO conspiratorial theorist. He was before Congress saying that we have captured alien craft and non-human biologics, is what his quote is.
Right.
And so between these videos, Dr. Ross, and these testimonies before Congress, Jeremy Korbel, the internet is abuzz with Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men again. So we thought it would be wonderful to have you on and have us talk about a Christian perspective in all this and try to make sense of everything. Dr. Ross, where do we even begin in looking at this phenomenon that is causing a resurgence of interest in the culture today?
Well, we are planning to put out a second edition of Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. Not that anything in the first edition needs to be changed. Everything in there is still valid, but there's a lot more evidence that we can bring to bear to sustain the scientific model that we produced in that book. So we're eagerly looking forward to doing that. And yes, I did do a podcast and wrote a short article where I responded to David Grusch's testimony before Congress. And what a lot of people don't realize is David Grusch has been making these kinds of claims for over 5 years.
Oh.
And what's interesting is when he testified before Congress, he substantially softened his claims, because what he's been saying in the past 5 years is that our U.S. government actually has the bodies of UFO beings.
Mm-hmm.
He said before Congress, well, they have biologic material. But I interpret that he's claiming that the U.S. government has actual biological tissue, maybe not complete bodies, but tissue. And then he's also claiming that our U.S. government has, you know, recovered these spacecraft from aliens that have visited our planet, and are reverse engineering these spacecraft in order to advance our technology. Over the past 5 years, he's also made the point that the reason why the ancient Egyptians and the Incas were able to construct the amazing structures that they did is they had the help of extraterrestrial aliens.
Really?
Yeah, these are the claims that are being made. And he's not the only one. There's a lot of people out there on the internet and on podcasts and radio and TV shows that are making similar claims. The History Channel has brought up several episodes where they're making these claims. So it's not just David Grusch. But for several reasons, some of which are already in the first edition of Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, we can definitively state these claims have no credibility. And I was impressed that the members of the committee, the Congress committee, are now drawing the same conclusions. They said, we've listened to his testimony, we've looked at the so-called evidence, and we can't find anything credible in the statements. A lot of, you know, hearsay evidence, but no direct evidence. And, you know, what I pointed out in our podcast and the article that I posted on our reasons.org website is that, number one, no one has been able to produce an artifact, something you could actually put in a museum, something that scientists could actually touch and do experiments on. You know, I personally have seen lunar rocks on several occasions. I've not handled them personally, but I've actually been up close and watched scientists handling these lunar rocks. And there's dozens of research papers in the scientific literature talking about what has been discovered in these rocks. You can do a scientific literature search. You'll find nothing like that on UFO artifacts. There are no artifacts. And the idea that our government has been hiding these from public purview ever since 1933, well, that's my second point. As Mark Clark, my co-author, would point out, the U.S. government does not have the security system in place to hide that kind of evidence from the U.S. public, certainly for not that period of time. I mean, what he pointed out is that we have a past president who tried to hide a single audio cassette tape from the public. And with all the power of the executive branch behind him, he could only keep it hidden for 11 days.
Chuck Colson tells that story, right?
Right, he does. And, you know, the idea that the U.S. government's got hangars with alien spacecraft that are 50 feet or bigger across. I mean, if that were really true, there would have been some exposure of that kind of evidence. Nothing like that has come forward. But to me, the strongest piece of evidence is that we can simply appeal to the laws of physics and point out that it's impossible for any large physical craft to traverse interstellar space. And what I'm looking forward to putting in the second edition of our book is the project that a number of astronomers are eagerly hoping will get funded. And it's not that expensive. It's a project to send spacecraft to the nearest planet. Now, this planet outside of our solar system is only 4.2 light years away. So it's relatively nearby. But it means to get there, you're going to have to move the spacecraft at least 10% the velocity of light. And with Einstein's equation E equals mc squared, the faster your spaceship goes, the more damage your spaceship receives from dust and particles in interstellar space, and the damage goes up with the square of the velocity. So if you go 20% the velocity of light, you get four times the damage that you do at 10% the velocity of light. And so astronomers have actually proposed, let's send 1,000 tiny spacecraft to the nearest planet outside of our solar system. And that's the other physical principle. The bigger your spacecraft, the more damage you'll receive. So you want to make the cross section small enough to minimize the damage. And the biggest size that physicists have determined is possible to traverse 4 light years is 10 centimeters. That's the biggest spaceship that you can send across interstellar space. And even at 10% the velocity of light, you're going to want to send 1,000 of these spaceships, recognizing that at least half of them will be totally destroyed before they get to the nearest planet outside of our solar system. The other half will be partly destroyed, but they'll be partly destroyed in different ways. And the idea is, hey, we can make these spaceships fairly cheaply and to send them to the nearest planet. If we send 1,000 of them, we should be able to get back some useful information within 42 years. But the bottom line is, there's no way you're going to send a termite from a stellar system that's, say, 100 light years away. You can't even send a microbe, let alone some being the size of a human being. And so we can say, without any question whatsoever, it's simply physically impossible for physical beings, physical biological beings, bigger than a microbe, to be able to traverse interstellar space. So on that basis alone, the claims by David Grusch, and he's not the only one, hundreds of other people have been making these claims. We know that's not the case. In fact, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men is one of 7 books I know that have been written on the UFO phenomena, or what's now called the UAP phenomena, unidentified aerial phenomena, by physicists who devoted a minimum of 10 years to studying this phenomena. As far as I know, I'm the only Christian amongst the 7, but all 7 of us say we're not dealing with physical beings that are subject to the laws of physics. We're dealing with something interdimensional, something that's outside the space-time dimensions of the universe, something that's not subject to the laws of physics that govern the universe. Probably the most famous one that's doing that is Jacques Vallée, the French astrophysicist. He was the one that first came up with the term, we're dealing with something that's real but interdimensional.
So to put it in layman's terms, Dr. Ross, this was something that I hear that in researching this myself, I have some background lay interest in it, but I was fascinated with UFOs before I was a Christian. After I became a Christian, I started to think twice about what these might really be. And especially when I read just before becoming a Christian, I read Whitley Strieber's Communion and was utterly convinced that this man was telling the truth, despite he was a science fiction writer. But, and we'll get into the abductions in a little bit, but basically to sum up what you're saying is something that is inconsistent with the narratives that you hear from David Grusch and others,
right?
That we have high-tech aircraft or whatever you want to call it, in an impossible size, if you will, doing impossible things, and yet they crash when they get to Earth.
Yes.
And so they survive interstellar travel, and somehow they can't dodge the entropy that plagues our planet and everything else in the universe. They're successful in navigating halfway across the universe. They get here and they crash. That just does not jive with the high tech that they say that these machines represent. If it's high tech, they haven't figured out how to overcome entropy yet. But that just seems to be a fatal flaw in all of these narratives. Why are they always crashing? And why are there pieces being recovered from this material that is allegedly far more advanced than what we know about? That just seems to be inconsistent in the stories that you hear.
It does. But just to emphasize, there's claims that they've recovered pieces, but no one's ever been able to display a piece. The you go to a recent crash site, there's about 2,000 documented cases of UFOs crashing into the Earth. When you visit the crash site, you never find any debris or artifacts. Now, we're talking a physical spaceship. There will be debris. There will be artifacts, just like there is when an airplane crashes into the Earth. There's stuff there in the ground. But with the UFOs, there's nothing to recover. On the other hand, these crash incidents tell us that we're dealing with a real phenomena. It's not just a figment of people's imaginations. Because when you go to the crash site, you'll find a shallow crater as deep as 18 inches deep. And if there's snow, the snow is melted. The vegetation is damaged, but there's no artifacts. There's no debris. It has to be a real phenomena to explain what happens at the crash site. But the fact that there's no debris and no artifacts, and also where you have observers watching the UFO go through the atmosphere towards the crash site, in 100% of the cases, the observers tell us no sonic boom and no heat friction trailing behind the space, the UFOs that goes through the atmosphere. If it's a physical craft moving at that velocity, you will get a sonic boom and you will have heat friction. I mean, I've watched on several occasions the space shuttle going through the atmosphere, and you definitely see this heat friction trail behind the space shuttle, and you do hear two loud sonic booms. That's never been recorded in these UFO incidents. So once again, we're dealing with something that definitely is real, but it's not physical.
Interesting. So there is a tangible, it's interesting, Dr. Ross, because the visual that you see, what you've just described, is always in relation to light at night or in the sky or whatever. And this seems to be a clue in terms of what we're dealing with. It's non-physical, but luminous. And this seems to be, maybe getting ahead of this a little bit, what biblically might there be that is non-physical and luminous and capable of maybe transcending our known laws of physics?
Yeah, good point. Because when I was at the University of Toronto as a graduate student, I took a brief course from Carl Sagan, and he was extremely dismissive of UFOs. He says it's just simply a figment of people's imagination. No way is the UFO phenomena credible. But see, his worldview would not tolerate the possibility of non-physical reality. From Carl Sagan's perspective, the only reality is physical reality. I was a fairly new Christian at the time, but as a Christian, my worldview does tolerate the possibility of non-physical reality. After all, we're told that God the Father is spirit. As a spirit being, he's real, but non-physical. And the Bible tells us that God created two distinct species of intelligent life, human beings that are subject to the laws of physics and the cosmic space-time dimensions, and angels that are not subject to the laws of physics of the universe or the cosmic space-time dimensions. And he's constrained us human beings to the universe, but he's given to the angels the power to exit their realm and come into our realm, briefly visit, and go back to their realm. And so, looking at the scientific evidence for dealing with non-physical reality, I say, that's very compatible with what the Bible teaches. These interdimensional beings that Jacques Vallée, the agnostic astrophysicist, speaks about, from my Christian perspective, we're talking about angels. And you say, well, what kind of angels? Well, this is something we document in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, that when people have close encounters, and it was the American astrophysicist Alan Hynek in the 1960s, who coined the term close encounters of the first kind, second kind, third kind. And a close encounter of the first kind is where the human contactee is less than 500 feet away from the UFO phenomena. But when Alan Hynek and everyone I know, physicists I know, who's written about this says, we're dealing with something that's not friendly. We're dealing with something that's not benevolent. It's a malevolent phenomena. What the human contactees, the close encounters, they always have deleterious consequences. In fact, the best you're going to come away from with a close encounter of one of these UFOs or UAPs that can't be naturalistically explained will be terrifying recurring nightmares. It's a worst case scenario. Well, they've come up with close encounters of the fourth kind. The fourth kind is where the human contactee is killed by the encounter. And so, yes, there are many documented cases where the animals owned by the human contactee have been injured or killed, or even the human contactee himself gets killed or injured. So we're not dealing with something that's benevolent, not at all.
Well, Jeremy Corbell, in his interview with Joe Rogan, talked about an interview that he had with a gentleman who remained anonymous who saw one of these lights appear over his work area. It was some kind of military organization or government organization. And the striking thing about this testimony was that the individual was afraid, and he also somehow sensed that, the light that he was observing doing the strange motions in the sky somehow exuded intelligence.
Yes.
And I've heard that more than once from people who are describing this phenomenon, that they can't explain it in words, but somehow they intuit that the light that they're seeing is behaving like it knows something. Do you find that to be the case in the research that you've done? You hear that a lot?
Yes, I've been studying UFOs since I was 16. Never intended to become a UFO expert. But because I was an amateur astronomer and knew nighttime phenomena really well, they always put me in charge of processing UFO reports at the different institutions where I served. And I also would hear from people who had these close encounters that they were terrified. And so they not only sensed that they were dealing with some kind of intelligent source, but they also recognized that this was something that was scary. So similar to what people experience when they have encounters with ghosts or spirits, a similar thing, which again is consistent with the idea we're dealing with an angelic phenomena rather than something that's within the physics of the universe. That's something else that's interesting. Again, these six other physicists who have written full-length books on the UFOs, none of whom are Christians, they all say what we see in the residual UFO phenomena, the phenomena that doesn't have a natural explanation or can be explained by a hoax or secret military activity by different governments of the world. And in my research, that's about 1% of what people report to me as a UFO or a UAP. But in that 1% category, what's interesting is that these other physicists say we see a one-to-one correspondence in this 1% residual, as we also see in the occult and demonology. And so a lot of them say we don't believe in demons, but we certainly see a one-to-one correspondence in what people claim in demonic encounters and what they claim in close encounters with these residual UFOs.
That's absolutely fascinating. I appreciate you making that connection. Let's talk a little bit about what is the primary, I guess, drive or interest, Dr. Ross, that you see that makes this so intriguing and compelling. This doesn't, as I was looking into the research of this myself, I looked back all the way into the medieval period, and I ran into the etymology of nightmare, and in the medieval era, of the idea of a demon sitting on people's chests and causing suffocation, or there are various different manifestations that all sound very similar to the occult, demonology, and even sort of the UFO phenomenon, where centuries ago it was magic and witchcraft, which obviously is still reality today. But It was C.S. Lewis in his book. He makes this wonderful point in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where Eustace Scrubbs sees a water pump functioning by itself, and he calls it technology, and another person in his crew calls it magic. And Lewis's whole point was that magic and technology are somewhat indistinguishable. And so it seems like this deception is being promulgated through our, I don't know what the right word is, idolatrous reliance upon technology, that we think this is high tech. Rather than calling it magic, we call it high tech. That seems to make it more acceptable, I suppose, because it's something along the lines of physics and science, that this stuff, like Joe Rogan and Jeremy Corbell were at a loss for words, really. They did not, their worldviews didn't have a vocabulary to describe what has been going on, but they kept falling back on high technology. Instead of calling it magic or witchcraft or metaphysical reality or some kind of spiritual realm, they limited themselves to science vocabulary. But as you've said, some of these physicists that have written about this they don't believe in the metaphysical reality, but it certainly does look like that's what we're dealing with. Do you think it is the scientific respectability aspect of this that gives these more credence? They're appearing on radars and in aircraft from the Air Force, that there's a science aspect to it that makes this more plausible, do you think?
Well, there's a science aspect that makes them more plausible, but that's relatively recent. I think it's important to point out this UFO or UAP phenomena is not new. It goes back thousands of years.
Yeah.
Thutmose III reported an encounter with a UFO in his records. That dates back 3,000 years. What is interesting, though, is that this UFO phenomena keeps pace with human technology.
Yes.
For example, if you were to go back 100 years ago, people were reporting encounters with UFOs as if they were encountering slow-moving dirigibles in the atmosphere. And we speed up to World War II, and you have a lot of fighter pilots talking about how they were encountering these Foo Fighters. And these were so-called aircraft moving at the speed of sound. Well, what we're seeing in the 21st century is that the UFO phenomena are now reported at moving at 10, 15, 25,000 miles per hour. And so I find it fascinating that it's keeping pace with human technology. And so trying to persuade people, hey, giving them a little bit of trying to, if the demons are really, the fallen angels are really out to deceive us, I would expect them to try to relate to where we are right now. The other thing I find interesting is that when people have, like a close encounter of the second kind is where there's actual communication between the so-called UFO being and the human contactee. And in those cases, where the human contactee says, well, where are you from? Well, 100 years ago, they said, we're from the backside of the moon. But once the lay public became aware, hey, there's no way you can have life on the backside of the moon, they changed their story. They said, well, we're from Venus. And when people realized how hot it was in the surface of Venus, they said, well, we're from Mars. And when the 21st century, people became aware, hey, the only place you can have advanced life in the solar system is planet Earth, they said, well, we're from another planetary system. That's the story they're telling now. What's interesting is they're keeping pace with a lay level knowledge of astronomy. However, when you compare what they're saying to the contactees with what astrophysicists know about the universe, we find flaws. It's like, okay, it's adequate to deceive someone who's not trained in astrophysics. But someone is realizes, you know what, this has no credibility.
Well, you bring up to mind, I was exactly, you probably have this in mind, Betty Hill from the famous early 1960s Betty and Barney Hill abductee story.
Right.
Where under hypnosis, Betty recalls or she sketches out a star pattern. And just to your point, Dr. Ross, she draws the planet from which these alien beings allegedly emanated and shows a pattern of stars. And then there was a lay astronomer, I forgot her name, she passed away in 2013, who did a who sort of did her own homework on the star patterns that were described by Betty Hill, that have since been fully discredited by our burgeoning astrophysical knowledge of star patterns. But that's to your point, that it was enough to deceive Betty that she was really looking at planets and stars. But in the 1960s, we were just beginning to talk about stars with habitable zones. And we didn't discover until the early 2000s, we actually kind of knew they were there, but exoplanets started to come into the foray. And now we are talking about, well, how could there not be life out there? Look at all the planets, right? And it, so it does seem, Dr. Ross, that that if we are being deceived by demons, they are aware of they're reading our popular literature in astronomy.
They're reading the popular literature, but they're not reading the peer-reviewed scientific literature.
They know they're not going to get away with it with you guys.
Well, that's the other thing you notice, is that when they have these close encounters with human beings and there's communication going on, they seem to tailor their story for the human contactee. So when I was at the University of Toronto, I was aware of two astronomers that were having these UFO experiences. And so what I noticed was these fallen angels treated them differently than they did the lay public. So, and you'd expect that from an intelligent being, that they would behave that way. But the very fact that they're keeping pace with our technology, they're keeping pace with the lay level of astronomical knowledge, and they keep changing their story, tells me that their motive is to deceive. I mean, if they were really communicating the truth, why would they keep changing their story? And why would they keep changing the way they appear to the contactees?
Right, right.
Now, the strongest evidence I see for deception is where you have automatic writing taking place. And this is where the human contactee is put into a trance, and they're in front of a computer, and the UFO being basically works through the human contactee to write. And the most famous example of that is the Arantia book.
Yes.
The Arantia book is the Bible of four different UFO religions. Now, there's more than four, but there's four that are functioning here in the United States. And these religions, their Bible is the Arantia book, and it's actually bigger than the Bible of Christianity. You know, some editions run 4,000 pages. But what's interesting about the Arantia book, a third of its content is focused on denying the deity of Jesus Christ.
Wow.
So it seems like when there's this automatic writing going on, the automatic writing is targeted to trying to persuade people that Christianity is not true.
That's fascinating, because that's true. You don't hear these alien stories talking about the falsehood of Joseph Smith or Muhammad or Krishna or Vishnu or any one of the gods that you can think of. It is always laser focused on some aspect or denying some aspect of who Jesus is.
Right.
And that underlies this whole thing. I wanted to get your thoughts on a quote that I got from astrophysicist, or he's a physicist. Do you know Dr. Paul Davis? Do you know him personally?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We've had several very enjoyable conversations with one another publicly.
He seems like a really nice man.
He is.
Is he an atheist agnostic or an agnostic atheist? Do you know his disposition?
He refers to himself as an agnostic, but he seems very intrigued by the biblical creation model we've developed here at Reasons to Believe.
Yeah.
And the last two conversations I had with him, I felt, gee, he seems really open to the Christian faith, but he made it very clear he cannot handle the baggage of the church.
Right.
And, you know, Paul was raised in Britain, and he's referring to the Anglican Church. And frankly, I'd have a hard time handling the baggage of the Anglican Church the way it's structured today. So I'm sympathetic to Paul's problem, but also shared with him, you know, you don't have to be stuck with that baggage.
Right.
But it's kind of a warning to all of us who are Christians. We need to strip away the baggage that's stopping people from seriously considering
right.
the Christian faith.
We have a lot of unnecessary portmanteaus in our closet, preventing
right.
As stumbling blocks. You invite people into their house and they trip over your luggage and they don't want to come back. But I wanted to read this quote. I figured you probably knew Dr. Davies, and I got this from his book, The Eerie Silence. And I'm not by any stretch of the means picking on Dr. Davies, but I think his quote is the general consensus, I believe, that exists in a sort of what I would call loosely the UFO community about what it would do to Christianity. And Dr. Davies says this: undoubtedly, the most immediate impact of an alien message would be to shake up the world's faiths. The discovery of any sign that we are not alone in the universe could prove deeply problematic for the main organized religions, which were founded in the pre-scientific era and are based on a view of the cosmos that belongs to a bygone era. Christianity is the religion most challenged by the concept of extraterrestrial beings, because Christians believe that God became a human being, specifically a Jewish political dissident. Jesus Christ was the savior of Homo sapiens. Anyway, he goes on to conclude that Christianity, of all the religions, would be the most negatively impacted by any kind of extraterrestrial message. But I think, Dr. Ross, it would seem that Christianity is actually the only worldview with a conceptual framework that can explain this phenomenon. What do you think about his quote there?
Interesting quote, but what Paul's not aware of is that Christian theologians have been debating this issue ever since the birth of the church 2,000 years ago. And the debate is about evenly split. You'll find over the past 2,000 years, Christian theologians arguing that when you look at, say, Psalm 104, it portrays God as really enjoying creating. And what you see in Psalm 104 is that God has filled the earth with a huge variety of life forms to such a degree there's nowhere you can't go where you're not going to find living creatures with amazing diversity. And so Christian theologians have said, well, that kind of a God is going to create life elsewhere. He's not going to stop with planet Earth. He seems to enjoy creating so much. And given the size of the universe, he must have created life forms everywhere. And then you've got theologians on the other side to say, well, when you look at the Gospels, notice how frequently Jesus refused to perform a miracle. It seems like God only performs the miracles necessary to achieve his purpose. And the stated purpose we see in the Bible is to bring an uncountable number of humans into a redemptive relationship with himself. And so they argue, well, in that context, God only needs one planet on which we have intelligent, advanced life. So they argue we're alone. But literally for 2,000 years, the Christian debate has been split above 50-50. Those who say God has created life in multiple places in the universe, and those who say God has only done it on a planet Earth. The only constraint that I think you could attribute to this, and maybe Paul refers to this, you see in Hebrews 9 and 10 that the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, who created everything that exists, came one time, one place, to redeem. And therefore, people have argued, well, one place is planet Earth. There wouldn't be beings in other planets that need a redemption. But there's been pushback on that too, where Christian theologians have said, look, we got television sets. Maybe these intelligent spiritual aliens on other planets also have the capability of recognizing what Jesus did here on planet Earth. And so his redemption, one time, one place for all, could apply to beings beyond planet Earth. They also point out that Hebrews in no way restrains God from creating dolphins or chimpanzees on another planet. Even if you interpret it very concretely, it would only eliminate the possibility that God has not created intelligent spiritual beings on another planet that's in need of redemption. Again, it's a fertile debate. I've written an article on this. It's posted at reasons.org on the biblical constraints of extraterrestrial life. The point I made in that article is if you're a Christian, you've got options. But if you're an atheist, you don't have options. As an atheist, you're compelled to believe that the origin of life is physically an easy step, and that that life will inevitably evolve into intelligent life. So from an atheistic perspective, the universe must be filled with intelligent beings. For atheists, it's Star Wars all over in every galaxy. But if you're a Christian, you get options. You can have it that way, or you could not have it that way. And so it's the atheists that are closed-minded. It's the Christians that are open-minded.
Mm. I think it was Carl Sagan on Johnny Carson before Cosmos came out. Carson really liked Carl Sagan. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of his interactions with Johnny. They're fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
But it was Sagan who said in a very demure sort of way that he does, he said, well, you know, radio signals do go out from our planet, but you have to think about what the first television shows were that have extended beyond our sphere. Milton Berle, Howdy Doody. And Sagan says, you know, you got to wonder if aliens are picking up our TV shows, if they think that we're really intelligent. It was kind of funny. it does show the point that the conceptual framework of the Christian faith leaves room for these things. And I think that is not only can explain current phenomenon, but it can also rest in the fact that whether there is or is not an abundance of life elsewhere in the cosmos, Jesus is Lord and creator of everything, as Colossians says.
Right. But as an astrophysicist, I would point out that at least so far, all of our astronomical observations tell us everywhere beyond planet Earth, it's hostile for advanced life. Some of my peers believe maybe we can find a planet with a microbe on it, but we're not going to find beings like us. Because everywhere we look, we see galaxies that have characteristics that eliminate the possibility of advanced life. We can't even find a star other than our star, the sun, that has a characteristic so it permit a planet to orbit it in which advanced life is possible. And you mentioned earlier habitability, the planetary habitable zone. Well, if you go to the NASA website, the only one they talk about is the liquid water habitable zone. That's the most generous of the known planetary habitable zones. But there are 14 that astronomers are aware of now. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 14 of the known planetary habitable zones. And so far, we know of only one planet that resides in more than two of those 14. It's the same one that resides in all 14, and you only get one guess as to which planet that is.
Earth.
Yes.
So there's 14 different criteria to be life-supporting as a planet. Is that what you're saying?
That's planetary criteria.
Wow.
In addition to that, you got the galactic habitable zones and the extragalactic habitable zones. I mean, my latest book, Design to the Core, goes into all these habitability requirements. And it's on that basis that people like Neil deGrasse Tyson said, when you look at the universe, it's out to kill us. Once you get past planet Earth, it's really deadly.